on the brink of a humanitarian crisis. That's how Butte County's housing director describes the ongoing Camp Wildfire evacuee situation. We'll hear from him. Also, smoke continues to choke the Sacramento Valley. Health warnings now the norm. How much longer might this last? We'll hear from air quality and weather experts with the latest. Ezra David Romero explains forest management plans as the length and severity of California's wildfire season expands. Our sound advice segment features Gary Vercelli, who has the perfect jazz picks for your next dinner party. And the Sacramento-based band Vinnie Guidera and the Deadbirds joins us in studio to perform their mix of indie and acoustic rock. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak this week. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak today. This morning's update from the Camp Wildfire burning in Butte County shows crews are gaining some ground. It's now listed at 40% containment, and it only grew slightly to 140,000 acres overnight. More than 9,000 structures have been destroyed. Nearly 8,800 of those were homes. There are still more than 15,000 structures listed as threatened. The sheer number of people forced out of their homes is exacerbating an already troubled housing situation in Butte County. Ed Mayer is the executive director of the county's housing agency. He says the campfire has pushed the area to the brink of humanitarian crisis.
So we have a lot of seniors and disabled living in this area, and particularly up in Paradise, who are low income and who have very little recourse in an event like this. So the challenge is, of course, is that we've got 6,000 to 7,000, maybe more, displaced families from Paradise. They're not going to find housing in our county anytime soon. We already had a very low, effectively zero vacancy rate here. So the long and the short of it is we're looking at 6,000 to 7,000 families who we can either choose to try to keep in place as long as possible, the many years it will take to rebuild the community to be able to reintegrate them, or the plain and simple of the matter is that they're going to have to go somewhere else. And the prospects are not good in California, which is generally challenged by housing shortages. So we're looking at folks being displaced around the country. The rub in all of this is, of course, we're talking low-income seniors and disabled who really don't have the means to move about the country. So when we talk of humanitarian crisis, pre-campfire, we were talking about the homeless. Where do they go to the bathroom? Where do they shower? How do they care for themselves? The refuse that humans generate naturally, that was part of our community discussion. Now this discussion has just blown up, and we have thousands of families camping out in Walmart parking lots, at refugee centers, at resettlement centers, I guess you'd call them. But it challenges every bit of our system's ability to triage these families. So humanitarian because we have many families, many households, particularly vulnerable, who have no recourse and no place to go. And our services are not structured to deal with 6,000 to 7,000 households at a time. It's a beautiful thing to watch people take care of each other in an emergency. In rural areas, I think it's particularly beautiful. You have a culture here of people helping each other out. And so when we have a catastrophe like this, it's what we've witnessed is a lot of people helping each other out and sharing unconditionally, incredible generosity coming in from around California. And so we're seeing this, how should I say, general celebration of humanity, but this stands in stark contrast to the reality of the situation, and as time wears on, things are not going to be so happy. But we do have folks, you know, struggling to stay warm. The nights are getting very cold now. They're intense. People are sleeping in their cars with their engines on. This is really, when we're talking seniors and disabled, low income particularly, one health condition can spin into a life-threatening event. So sleeping outdoors in these situations is really challenging. There are homes in Paradise and in the evacuation areas. We have had no news about when the community may be allowed to revisit the Paradise Magalia area or the canyons around them. The first responders are still just digging out. They're still working with an active fire. Up in Paradise in particular, they're looking for bodies. It takes quite a while to clear an area. My expectation is until power and water are restored and areas are cleared, that you're not going to see much access to these areas. So best guess, and this is a guess because we don't have any active information, is we're looking at anywhere from a couple weeks to 3 months to begin to be able to get access to these areas. So if folks, and we are aware, I became aware this morning of some, there's holdouts, folks who did not honor the evacuation, who are still, let's say, in Paradise, in their homes. They survived. They can't leave the evacuation area and come back. So they're in their homes, and of course, they're living on whatever water and food they had stored in their homes. Interesting situation. Whether they get to stay or how they get to stay will be interesting to see how it plays out. But long and the short of it is, no one's going back into these areas anytime soon. So this is a marathon, not a short walk.
Butte County Executive Director of Housing Ed Mayer earlier this morning, as you heard him there, he said it could be weeks, even months, before the Paradise area is reopened to its residents. Air quality because of the wildfire has been in the health warning or health alert range for days and shows no signs of easing up today. Joining us to discuss the state of our air is Lori Kobza, spokeswoman for the Sacramento Air Quality Management District. Lori, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Lori, when I spoke to you on Friday asking you about the air situation, you said at that point the Bay Area had been inundated with smoke, but Sacramento had been pretty clear up to that point. And you said it's coming, and then it could stick around till Wednesday. Well, now it's Thursday.
Yeah, it's here, and it's going to be here for the foreseeable future.
Is that right?
We did extend our wildfire smoke health statement along with Sacramento County Public Health. We extended it yesterday to go through Friday. It's very possible that on Friday we will extend it again. We still have to take it on a day-to-day basis, but we are looking at weather conditions that just aren't changing. And because of that, all of the smoke is just trapped here. And for the Sacramento Valley and where we are in Sacramento County, it's coming through, and actually Placer County, it's everywhere. It's coming through the canyon from up there, and we are in a drainage canal, basically, for air, and we are just getting slammed with the pollution. So I empathize with all of your listeners because I know how difficult it is right now, and we are all doing our best to get correct information out to the public. The most important thing, and I know you have said this over and over again, and people have heard it in many places, but the best thing to do is to stay indoors and minimize your outside activity.
And I imagine when you're indoors, if there's a way to filter the air in there as well, that would even enhance your situation.
That can help. I am not sure about the different types of indoor air quality filters that exist. So that is something that your listeners can look into on their own to determine if there is something that might do a good job of filtering particulate matter 2.5. A lot of times those indoor air filters are good for filtering out mobile source emissions from outside. Particulate matter 2.5 can be a little bit different when it comes from wildfire smoke. So I have encouraged people to put, towels around their doors and around their windows, things like that, because PM 2.5 is so microscopic, and that's why we are concerned about it from a health perspective, because it not only gets into your lungs, but it can get into your bloodstream.
And what are some of the effects you might feel at that point?
Well, if you are somebody who already suffers from a heart or a lung condition, it can definitely make you feel much sicker. You can get an increased shortness of breath. You can have heart arrhythmia. It can cause heart attacks in people as well. So for your listeners out there who already have a pre-existing condition, it's very, very important that if they are feeling any symptoms that they think is related to the smoke or they don't know, that they contact their doctor. Contact your medical health provider at all time. That's really the first line of information for anybody out there who already has a condition. For a healthy person, I think we're all starting to feel effects of longer term, and the longer it goes, the more effects people will feel. We're having folks who are complaining of nosebleeds and the cough and the catch in the throat where you're doing this all day long, burning eyes, general fatigue, and emotional fatigue sets in as well. people aren't used to having this much smoke in this area at such high levels consistently.
Is this unprecedented?
And it is very unique, especially for Sacramento County, because when there have been other fires, sometimes it'll hit Placer County or El Dorado, but miss Sacramento County. Or it'll hit Yolo Solano counties and Placer County and maybe a part of Sacramento County. But there have usually been places where people can go to get out of it, if you will. That's just not the case with this fire and with how the weather conditions are. So it's all coming in. It's going to be here for the next several days. I will have an update in the next several hours, and so I will provide that to you and your team so you can provide updated information to your listeners.
And we'll share that during All Things Considered, of course, this afternoon. Lori, during this digital age, this bad air quality is sending a lot of people to smartphone apps and online to look at these resources that show these colored bubbles that tell you, that gives you a number, you know, 200, 300, 400 range lately, indicating how bad the air quality is in your neighborhood. What do people take away from those numbers? I feel like we have this new information, but a lot of us haven't been schooled on it.
You know, I think the numbers I wouldn't focus on as much. I would focus on the color. That's also easier for people to digest. And that's why the Air Quality Index was created by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency well over 10, 12 years ago, maybe even longer now. I've been doing this work myself since 1993, and sometimes the years run together. But the Air Quality Index was created to give those colors. So green is good or healthy. Yellow is moderate. Orange is unhealthy for sensitive groups. A sensitive group includes those people who already have a health condition. Children, because their lungs are still growing and they breathe in pound for pound more air than we do as adults. Outdoor workers, pregnant women, athletes, those outdoor athletes, I will emphasize, that falls into an unhealthy for sensitive groups category. Then red is unhealthy for everybody, meaning anyone could feel health effects. Then after that is purple, which is very unhealthy. And then higher than that is maroon, which is hazardous. We have had periods of hazardous readings in the Sacramento region that have lasted for hours. They might not last for a full 24, but they last long enough. And therefore, the sad reality is there isn't much that people can do to get out of it except for staying indoors. And then it raises the question of indoor air quality. Everybody's home is built differently. Weather stripping is different from home to home. Ventilation is different from office building to office building. So I still feel, and the experts have still told me, that it is better to be inside than outside. But people are going to have to use their own good judgment. And if they're feeling uncomfortable, or if there's just a situation that they're not good in, then they need to remove themselves from it.
Lori, if you're an outdoor worker, do you have any sort of recourse with your employer when it gets into this hazardous zone that you can say, hey, the air outside is hazardous. I can't be at work today.
You know, that I don't know. That would be a question for the Division of Occupational Safety and Health or Cal OSHA. One of those organizations might be able to address that particular question. I'm not sure what type of resource outdoor workers have.
Sacramento City Unified School District says it consulted with your organization regarding its decision to hold classes today. Other districts have chosen to close, as have colleges and universities, including Los Rios Colleges, Sac State, Stanislaus State, UC Davis. There are many factors Sac Unified, of course, takes into account. But when it comes to your agency's consultation, what sort of information are you providing?
I'm providing the same information to the Sacramento County Public Health Officer, who is then providing that information to the school district superintendents. And I'm also providing the same information to any of the school district's staff that contact me. The Sac Metro Air District is responsible for providing the air quality information as a resource. Ultimately, it is the purview of the Sacramento County Public Health Officer and the school district superintendents to make a decision whether they cancel class or not. There are many factors that go into deciding whether to keep class going or not. I can tell you that for several school districts, they are doing what they feel best meets the needs of all of their students, and they're following recommendations for when students are at school in these situations to stay indoors, no recess, no outdoor PE, etc. These are extraordinary times that we're dealing with, and staying open at school, students feel safe, they're supervised, they're learning. Everybody's home environment, and I gave this same statement to a member of the public that I was talking to earlier today, everybody's home environment is different. Not everyone has the ability as a parent to stay home from work to supervise a child when school is out of session, or to make sure that that child doesn't go outside. In a school environment, the teachers, the principal, the superintendent, all the school staff are aware of the air quality situation and the information that we are providing to them, and they can make sure that the children are not outside and breathing in more air than they should.
Lori Kobza with Sacramento Air Quality Management District on the state of our air during the ongoing Camp Fire. Thank you so much, Lori.
You're welcome. Thank you, and call anytime. Take care, everybody.
Absolutely. Let's turn now to Eric Kurth. He's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Sacramento. Hey, Eric.
Hello. Good morning.
So what's the prognosis in terms of the air shifting in a way that we might be able to clean it out, not just for the Sacramento area, but to the north in Chico and Butte County, where they've even had more accelerated numbers than what we're seeing here?
Yeah, this is a tough time of year to have a wildfire. We usually have wet conditions and the grass is green, so we usually don't see this kind of event. And we get very strong inversions, which have been trapping that smoke. And it really doesn't have anywhere to go until we get a system to clear it. There's a bit of a hint that we're going to get something Saturday night into Sunday, which will act to clear the smoke to some degree. Unfortunately, though, it will also maybe cause the campfire to flare up a little bit more, and that could produce more smoke. So in terms of like a really long-term improvement, it's really rain that's going to make the difference.
And that's on a lot of people's minds. Any significant rain in the forecast as we head into the Thanksgiving holiday weekend?
Starting to get a little better confidence that we're going to see a change mid to late next week, potentially as early as Wednesday, but better chances later Thursday and Friday. So we're seeing a little better agreement with some of our computer models, I guess especially for more of that Thursday-Friday period.
Would that be a colder system or one of those warmer jet stream ones that hit us sometimes?
It's not going to be an especially warm system or a cool system either. It's going to be, kind of a typical system. But at this point, I think anything that brings us rain is exciting.
Right. Yes. And while it'll help with the fire situation and the smoke, of course, a lot of people traveling over Thanksgiving weekend. But I think we'll all deal with it in that case. Eric Kurth, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Sacramento. Thank you for the update. We appreciate that.
You're very welcome.
And of course, we'll have a lot more information at capradio.org/insight on all the topics you've heard so far this morning. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak. There is a lot of talk about forest management these days, as within the last year alone, several of California's largest and deadliest wildfires have swept through the state. Cap Radio's environment reporter Ezra David Romero has been reporting on calls to increase the use of prescribed burns on forest lands. We spoke with him earlier, and I began by asking how controlled burns work.
Prescribed burns happen in multiple stages. It's not like you just go out and light the forest on fire all of a sudden. There's a process to it. They have to go out and thin the forest first. That's where they mechanically go out and remove trees and brush that's overgrown. So when they light that patch of forest on fire on purpose, it doesn't turn into a wildfire.
And then I imagine there's also a lot of factors in play in terms of the weather, how the smoke will stick around, that it's not too windy, et cetera.
Yeah, every prescribed burn or controlled burn has an action plan. They think about everything from the weather that's happening that day. Is there an inversion layer that's going to trap the smoke into this area? Is it in a valley where the smoke can't escape? Or is there a community nearby that will get smoked out if all the weather conditions aren't perfect? So they think about every single detail. And I've tried to go on a number of prescribed burns over the past month, and a number of them I couldn't do every day. I was going to go every day, but they got cut off because the weather conditions weren't perfect.
And now some people are suggesting that prescribed burns may be the solution to California's growing wildfire problem.
Yeah, they're saying not the only solution. It's like a tool in a toolbox of solutions, but it's something that we can do now. You know, we have lighters and matches and things that can light the forest on fire. And I know in light of the mega fires that are happening in California, that might be seen negatively. But under a condition where it's being watched, where they've done forest management in this area, where they've thinned it and they've prepared the area, it could be a viable option.
How do they envision this working? Because right now, as I understand it, the prescribed burns are pretty small. Do they want to expand that?
Yeah, so a number of professors and scientists and forest managers I spoke with would like to expand the size of fires. So right now they're anywhere between like an acre, a quarter of an acre, sometimes even 100 or 200 acres. The one I went on last week was about 50 acres. And they would like to see them happen on a larger scale or just more frequent. And I think when people think of prescribed fires or fires, they think of them all happening at once. They might have a goal of burning 1,000 acres on the Tahoe National Forest, but they might not do it all at the same time. They might do it in chunks when the time is right, when all the weather conditions are right, when it's not too windy, when it's not too hot, when the humidity is higher rather than low, because low humidity dries out fuels, grasses, and things like that.
What are the arguments against this type of forest management?
I think the main thing is smoke. More and more people live in the mountains, live in these forested areas, and they don't want to be smoked out necessarily. And so there's sort of a negative perspective around fires anyways, right? When you see a fire, you think danger. And you see smoke, you think, especially today where we're having these big mega fires or large fires, when you see smoke, you think maybe that's going to come burn my house down. So the thought is to talk to the public beforehand, to educate them, to put signs up on the roads around these areas just to show that this prescribed fire is happening. So I think that's the main concern, is that there's too much smoke and they could maybe jump the lines of the set map of the prescribed burn, right? If the prescribed burn area is the area that's been set up and that's been thinned and all that, if it jumps the line, it could set a fire in the outside area.
And so while we are currently doing these smaller prescribed burns, as you said, they are ramping them up a bit.
Yeah, the Forest Service is doing a lot more prescribed burns. Hugh Safford, he's the regional ecologist for the Forest Service's Pacific Southwest region. That's California, Hawaii, and the Pacific Territories. He said this is the year they've done the most in a very, very long time.
So this year, we actually accomplished more area of prescribed fire than we have for many, many, many years. I think the value I saw in California was about 60,000 total acres on the California National Forest, which, let's be candid, it's a pretty small number, but it's much higher than what we've pulled off in recent years. And so we think that's pretty exciting.
And are supporters of prescribed burns in agreement with him that the 60,000 figure is exciting?
I think they think it's exciting, but they all say more can be done. And what makes it difficult is that, you know, when you see the Sierra Nevada, you see all the trees. I think often people think it's managed by the same group of people, the same agencies. But in fact, it's a very diverse group of people that are running that operation. You have the Forest Service, you have private land, you have state land, you have parks, you have easements and conservancies. And so you have this huge area and a lot of voices going on. So to even do a prescribed burn, you might have to have three or four agencies working together to get one done.
Where do ecologists fall in this debate?
Well, Hugh is one of these ecologists, and they like the idea of prescribed burns. But Hugh does make this point that prescribed burns aren't the one catch-all solutions for preventing major wildfires in California. He says they can help, but they're one tool in the toolbox. So let's hear what he has to say about that.
That prescribed fire on its own will never solve this problem. And it won't even be close. It's a tool that we need to use for a variety of reasons. But really, the major things that have to happen, one, is that we have to start getting serious about using naturally ignited fires under appropriate, safe conditions, of which even under the current climate, there are a lot, way more than we use. And then secondly, we also need to get serious about using, mechanical, sort of human-driven forest treatment as a surrogate wherever we can do it, hopefully followed up by prescribed fire or natural wildfire where possible. But the scale of the problem is absolutely massive. And even if we were to double or triple the amount of prescribed fire we're doing, it wouldn't come close to solving the problem.
When he talks about mechanical treatment of the forest, he's talking about forest thinning, correct?
Yeah, he's talking about forest thinning. That's where either there's hand crews going in and actually like cutting down trees with chainsaws, or they have these giant tractor-like machines that can pick up whole giant 100-foot trees and treat them like toothpicks. And they put them in piles, different piles, like things that can go be turned into boards, things that have to be burned, things that maybe can go to a biomass facility to make energy. And so that's what he's talking about.
Yeah, as I understand it, forest thinning became a tool for the Tahoe Basin to keep another Angora fire from kicking up over the past decade.
Yeah, it's sort of a practice that's used everywhere. You know, I was in the Tahoe National Forest about 3 weeks ago on a ride along, and we saw all this forest thinning happening. But it's also expensive. You're running these giant machines. You're paying contractors to come out to run these machines. You have to figure out what to do with all this resources that you have in big piles now. And you have to figure out what to do with it. Do you leave it and let it dry and burn in a year or two? Do you take it to a biomass facility where they turn it into energy? Those are some questions that are unanswered and sometimes hard to answer because sometimes there's just nowhere to put all that wood.
Is the timber not of the quality that it could be sold on the market to recoup some of those costs?
From what I understand, some of it is and some of it isn't. It depends on if it's like bark beetle infested. And during the drought, we had all those trees that were the millions and millions of trees that were killed because of bark beetles, burrowing into them and basically sucking the life out of these trees. So not all of that wood is salvageable. But even the wood that is, when you see a whole tree, not all of that wood can actually be turned into timber. It has to be of a certain size. And so, limbs and branches and tops and bottoms that don't fit that specifications, they have to figure out something else to do with it.
In addition to the forest thinning and the prescribed burns, are there other tools that people are promoting?
From what I understand, it's mainly forest thinning first and then prescribed burns. But then there's also biomass facilities where they take all that wood stuff and turn it into energy. They burn it, capture that energy, and then you can power homes and things like that with it. And so there's not a lot of biomass facilities in California. And so, for example, on the Tahoe National Forest, for a long time, the nearest biomass facility was like 100-plus miles away. So it wasn't economical to move all that wood stuff that far. And so that's an option, but it's lower on the totem pole, I think, at this point.
Cap Radio's environment reporter Ezra David Romero on the push to increase the use of prescribed burns on forest lands in California. You can hear his full report. It's on our website at capradio.org. And of course, find more information on any topic you hear on Insight by heading to capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Cap Radio. This is Insight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak. Our sound advice segment this week features Cap Radio's jazz music director, Gary Vercelli, with a list of his favorite new songs. Gary's freshly back from a Cap Radio Travels trip to South America. So we started by asking about how that event went and some of the music he heard down there.
It was a great trip. We traveled with 40 jazz enthusiasts, and we were in Chile and Argentina. We heard some great straight-ahead bands, but also a band that mixed Argentine tango with jazz elements, and that was led by bassist Pablo Mota. Pablo was born in Argentina, but raised up in Los Angeles and played with some jazz greats there. And now he's back in his home country. And he spoke in between every song and gave some really interesting information about the bandoneon and about the folkloric music of Argentina.
And you wrote about your experiences for people to read online.
Yeah, capradio.org/travels. We have a blog there of my experiences, all the great wines we tasted, and the great music we heard.
They go great together.
Indeed.
People can get more information about that trip and others.
Yeah, I actually wrote a kind of a lengthy blog about all the music reviews. It's at capradio.org/travels. It talks about the wines we enjoyed and the music.
Music from Argentina and Chile are not part of your set today. What's the theme today?
We're looking at just great new releases that have really impressed me that we're playing a lot on 88.9.
Excellent. And we're starting with something by Benny Green?
Correct. Benny is a product of the Berklee school system, Berklee High School, which had a great jazz program. And he is joined here by vocalist Veronica Swift. They'll both be performing at the Mondavi Center February 27th through March 2nd. She's quite an impressive vocalist, and she comes from good jazz stock. Her father was pianist Hod O'Brien, her mother, vocalist Stephanie Nakasasian. A lot of people scat these days, but nobody is as prominently as Veronica Swift, and she's really a rising star in the jazz, on the jazz scene.
All right, let's move to your next piece here, and this one is A Few Miles from Memphis, The Iron Man.
Yeah, The Iron Man is the title of Harold Mayburn. He's an 82-year-old pianist. He's one of the idiom's unsung heroes. He's never really gotten the credit he deserves. He's worked with all the jazz greats, including Lee Morgan and Freddie Hubbard. And this is his 26th album as a leader. It's recorded live at a small club called Smoke in Harlem. And that's kind of a quintessential New York experience. If you're ever in Manhattan, go up to Smoke and hang out and hear Harold Mayburn.
Was recorded live. It almost sounds studio.
Yeah, good quality recording, and Smoke label is putting out a lot of good records. That featured Eric Alexander. He was a student of Harold Mayburn, and Harold said that when he first heard him, he knew that Eric had a promising future. Very funky tune written by a groove master, Harold Mayburn.
I like it. And we move into the always contemporary Yellow Jackets.
Yeah, the Yellow Jackets have a new member, and she's Brazilian vocalist Luciana Sosa. I'm not sure if she's just a guest on this album or if she's in the band now, but she's always contemporary, and this is an interesting exploration with her vocals and Bob Mincer's tenor saxophone. Oh,
As a non-music expert, I can't put my finger on it, but there is a Brazilian sound. Like, if somebody asked me, I could say that's Brazilian.
Yeah. Also, the Yellow Jackets were formed in 1981, so they've gone through a lot of evolutions, and this is kind of their latest version of what they're doing. But I enjoyed it very much.
Your next piece is by Doug Webb.
Doug Webb is one of the most sought-after studio musicians in Los Angeles. He has a lot of television credits. When you hear Lisa Simpson wailing away on her saxophone,
that's him.
That's Doug Webb, and he's also contributed to Law & Order and other TV programs. But he's got several albums out on a small label. He plays in a real kind of aggressive style, except on this tune, which is a ballad, he kind of lays back, and it's very melodic.
That's really nice.
Isn't that pretty?
Yeah, I need that cut for playing at my house when I have people over for wine and cheese.
There you go. Jule Stein wrote that. It's called The Things We Did Last Summer, a real romantic piece.
And finally, you're going to close out with Miki Yamanaka?
Yeah, Miki Yamanaka, no relation to Devin Yamanaka.
I was going to mention that, right?
But she's a native of Japan. She works regularly in New York City, and she's been praised by such jazz greats as pianist Larry Goldings. This is from her brand new self-titled album, Miki.
Piece has got me relaxed just like the one before it. Those are some good
pieces. I was going to say more great music for your wine and cheese
right?
party.
Gary, it's great to have you back from Argentina, and we should remind people again they can get your list of reviews from the music that you heard while you were on your Cap Radio Travels trip at capradio.org/travels, right?
Correct. Thank you. I enjoyed being in with you.
Cap Radio's jazz music director, Gary Vercelli, with some of his favorite new songs, now likely one of your favorite new songs. Find that list and more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak this week. Sacramento indie rock band Vinny Gadara and the Deadbirds are here in studio today to debut new music from their second album, Shedding. And joining us here in studio is Vinny Gadara. Nice to have you here on Insight.
Thanks for having us.
Ian McDonald on drums.
Morning.
And Kevin Hayes on bass.
Good morning.
And so it's a trio. You didn't start out as a trio, though, right?
No, this was sort of a born of a solo project. We've been playing together since high school, but there was an offshoot of that where I played acoustic stuff by myself. And then a few years back, we started doing those songs with the full band. And that's how the first record came to be. And then this one we approached writing more as a group.
Mm-hmm. And you live in Sacramento. Now, you all live in Sacramento right now, and you grew up here as well?
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Awesome. Sacramento natives. That's the type of band we like to feature. Okay, tell us about the new album, Shedding. How is it different from your first record, Lows?
Not like the home improvement store, but LOWS.
No, not. It's not about lumber. we approached it differently as far as the writing process goes, kind of anticipating that it would be more full. And there's sort of more dynamic opportunities when we're writing as a full band on both the louder end of things and the quieter end of things, and that there's a lot of space between we can work in. So I think we experimented more with textures, and there's a little bit more lead guitar stuff on this one.
Let's hear some of that. We'll play a clip or a piece from the album, Part of the Act, and let's listen to it, and then you can describe what it's all about. Vinny, you mentioned textures earlier. Explain a little bit for us how your sound works. I know that you're using, at least in some cases, an acoustic guitar, but it's played through an electric setup. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a byproduct of this having started as a solo project. So I ended up plugging my acoustic into my old electric setup and toying around with that until I found a sound that I liked. It resonates a lot differently than an electric guitar would. So I think it sounds and feels fuller than playing an electric. Mm-hmm.
Kevin, you play bass. How do you describe, when people ask you, friends, family members, whoever you run into, how do you describe the band's sound? When I introduced you guys, I said a Sacramento indie rock band. But how do you describe yourself?
Right. We describe ourselves as indie rock, and it's hard to elaborate too much outside of that because we're kind of unique. I mentioned bands like Manchester Orchestra, kind of just an alternative dynamic band. Most of the bands that we mentioned that we sound like, a lot of people haven't heard of.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of try to get people to come to our shows to figure out
right.
what we sound like.
Hear it
like.
For yourself, and then right. you can describe it.
Yeah.
Ian, you're on drums, and if I understand it, this last album was sort of a do-it-yourself project where you built your own drum kit.
Both albums were. So between Lowe's and Shedding, I built myself a new drum kit because I don't have enough stress in my life. So I decided to do this like really insane project. But I think it turned out okay.
And this is the one behind you right now.
Yes,
here.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you a chance to climb into that because we're going to have you play
okay.
here in a matter of seconds, really. So I'll let you guys get into your positions. And Vinny, I'll ask you while you're getting into position here, what song are you going to play and what inspired you on this one?
We're going to be playing Vacation White, which was the first single on the new record.
Vacation Light or White?
White.
White.
It's about, convincing yourself that everything's okay.
Huh. Which some of us need to do around this time, right?
A real happy song.
Yeah. All right. Here we have Vinny Gadara and the Dead Birds playing Vacation White. Here we go.
Thank you.
Excellent. Vacation White, Vinny Gadara, and the Deadbirds live here in the Insight Studio. I know you're just now releasing the album Shredded, but is there, are you already on the vision for the third album?
No.
I think at this point, last time, we already had a few songs written for the second album, and this time we're not quite there yet.
No. Well, in bask in the moment right now. And Vinny, I'm going to have you sit back down in the chair if that's cool. Why was it important to you to have a vinyl version?
I'm a big fan of physical media, and I like the physical presentation of a record. We did it on colored vinyl, and that's part of the overall vision for what I had in mind for this record in general.
I want to talk a little bit about your upcoming album release party at Blue Lamp. It's on Saturday, right? Shotgun Sawyer and Eugene Ugly will also be there. You've played the Blue Lamp before?
We've played the Blue Lamp many, many times.
So you chose that venue because you like it a lot.
Yeah, that place feels like home.
Yeah, what is it about it that gives you that sense?
Oh, it's cozy. It sounds great. AJ and Chris, who do the sound, are great at their jobs. And Gabby and Ben are great to the bands that come through.
That's the one on Alhambra?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so... what takes place at an album release party? We have a lot of bands that come here, and it's just really you're playing all the new songs, and then of course album sales.
yeah. This will be the first and possibly only time we're going to play this one front to back, and we've got some visuals set up that are impractical for the average show, but we figured we'd do it up for this one.
Well, thank you so much for being in the Insight Studio today, you guys. I really appreciate it. Vinny Gadara on vocals there and also playing guitar, Ian McDonald on drums, and Kevin Hayes on bass. Vinny Gadara again, and the Deadbirds. You can find more information available on the band and the album release party at capradio.org/insight. And that is Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Insight produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Today's engineer was Anthony Van Hook. Our technical director, Mark Jones. Theme music composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We are back with another live show on Monday. As always, thanks for joining us.